You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Is broadly defined as non-banks, are beyond the banks. The groupings of these things is a little bit arbitrary. So non-banks includes Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, AIG, money market funds, and the auto companies for some reason, because they had to go somewhere and we didn't want to leave them out. We have a particularly good panel to discuss what was one, some of the most consequential decisions of the crisis and ones that may be with us for some time. Our lead speaker is going to be Bill Dudley, who is the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And then I'm joined by Scott Alvarez, who was the general counsel at the Federal Reserve Board, I think forever until recently. Is that right?
Right. I was born at the Federal Reserve.
And Steve Shaffrin, who was one of those people who was in the private sector and had the misfortune to have Hank Paulson know his phone number. And so was instrumental. You were in both administrations, right? In both the Bush and Obama administrations. Bill's going to kick this off, and then we'll turn to questions.
Okay, thank you. So first of all, I want to just thank Nellie Lang and Scott Alvarez for all the work they did on this paper. They deserve the credit for the paper on the non-bank financial sector. That said, as always, I have to issue my usual disclaimer. My comments today reflect my own views and not those of the Federal Reserve System. I'm on garden leave, so I still have a few weeks. And I'm also going to apologize. I'm only going to speak for a couple minutes, so there's a lot of stuff I'm going to leave out. So if you don't hear it mentioned, it's not my fault. I'm going to focus my remarks on answering three questions. First, why was the non-bank sector so important as part of the financial crisis? Second, what were the primary factors that drove the Fed's and the U.S. Treasury decisions with respect to Bear Stearns, Lehman, and AIG? And then third, what lessons should we take away from the financial crisis with respect to the non-bank sector? In particular, are we in a better place today than we were 10 years ago with respect to regulatory oversight and the tools we have available to use the next for the next time when we encounter a period of financial instability? So turning to the first question, I think what's different about the financial crisis was that the non-bank sector really played a key role. And the question is, why was that? As I see it, there were four important factors behind that. The first is that the securities industry, mortgage banking, finance companies, and the GSEs all grew very, very rapidly starting in the 1980s, and they grew to play a very significant role in the intermediation of credit in the U.S. economy. And that was due to many factors, but I think the most important one was the development of securitization and structured finance. That really facilitated the originate and distribute model, and that led to the development of global capital markets in which the securities firms were really able to compete effectively with commercial banks. So prior to the 1990s, we had investment banks that were tended to be private partnerships with very small balance sheets, and during that period, a major investment bank could fail. Think of Drexel Burnham failure in 1990, but the failure would typically not be systemic. In contrast, by the time of the financial crisis, we had very large investment banks who were global, very leveraged, and were dependent on wholesale funding to fund assets that were often either hard to value, think CDOs, or liquid, think commercial real estate. Second thing that was important was that the regulatory regime did not keep pace with these changes in the structure of the financial system. The focus of security regulators, both federal and state, was primarily on investor protection, not on financial stability or the safety and soundness of the firms that they regulated. In particular, the prudential standards with respect to liquidity and capital for securities firms were either very weak or non-existent. Third issue was that the central bank's authority to provide a lender of last resort backstop to non-banks was very limited. We've talked a lot already about Section 13.3, only can be used in unusual and exigent circumstances. The credit can only be extended if it's determined that the credit's not available from another source. So that means that the credit from a central bank to the non-bank financial sector can only be forthcoming only after circumstances have become very dire. So as a result of that, counterparties to securities firms could have very little confidence about when or whether a central bank was actually going to be willing to provide liquidity, which made runs much more likely. And then finally, there was no good resolution regime in place for large systemic non-banking firms. As we saw in the case of Lehman, the bankruptcy path turned out to be particularly problematic because it spurred a run on the money market mutual funds, which we'll touch on, and it led to the abrupt closeout of trillions of dollars of OTC derivatives contracts, which turned out to be very damaging. And it also raised questions about the viability of the other global securities firms that were still in business. So as we stood on the eve of the financial crisis, the non-bank sector was very fragile. And so when the housing bubble burst and home prices declined, we knew that the stress on this sector was going to increase. And as it increased, there was very little in the toolkit that the regulatory authorities had to respond as the circumstances deteriorated. And I think that made it just much more difficult to arrest the downward dynamic and to restore confidence. So in 2008, when faced with the imminent failures of Bear Stearns, Lehman, and AIG in short order, policymakers were faced with an important question. How far could they go in stretching the available tools, which were clearly inadequate, to limit contagion and constrain an ever-broadening financial crisis? So this turns to the second set of issues. So in determining whether to intervene, I think policymakers wrestled mainly with three major questions. The first was, would the failure of the institution likely cause material harm to the core of the financial system and to the overall economy? So if the firm failed, what would be the consequences? The second is, would a broader provision of liquidity to markets and other firms likely be sufficient to mitigate the effects of such a firm's failure? Could you provide broad-based liquidity? The firm fails, life goes on, it's not systemic. And the third is, could lending to the firm be sufficient to prevent its failure? Now, these are all questions that require judgment and certainly depend on the particular set of circumstances in place at the time that the judgment needs to be made. Suffice it to say, in the case of Bear Stearns and AIG, the answer to all three questions was judged to be yes. A failure would likely damage the core financial system and the economy. The provision of liquidity to the rest of the financial system would unlikely be powerful enough by itself to sufficiently limit the damage. And the firms were judged as still likely to be viable. Bear Stearns had a willing acquisition partner in the form of J.P. Morgan. And AIG, as we know, had major insurance subsidiaries that could be sold or that would, over time, provide support to the parent holding company. In contrast, for Lehman, the answer to the third question was judged to be no. Although Lehman might possibly have been judged as solvent on a book value basis in September 2008, the fact is that many of its assets were carried on the books at inflated valuations, and the firm's franchise was rapidly eroding. Moreover, I think it's important to recognize that Lehman failed an important market test. It was unable to raise capital on its own, and no acquirer was able to step forward on a timely basis and acquire Lehman, even with a large chunk of its more liquid impaired assets being removed from its balance sheet. So this brings us to the third question. So where do we stand today with respect to the non-bank financial sector, and what are the lessons we should have learned from the financial crisis? So as I look at it, today there are both positives and negatives. On the positive side of the ledger, all the major investment banks now are either part of bank holding companies or foreign banking organizations, and thus they're subject to capital and liquidity regulation, and they're subject to supervision that focuses on good governance, risk management, and safety and soundness. So that's a very different situation than we were in 2007. On the positive side, the Dodd-Frank Act does provide the authority for the Financial Stability Oversight Council to designate firms and activities to a more limited extent as systemic and subject to prudential regulation. So in principle, if new firms and activities were to emerge that were systemic, the regulatory safety net could be, the regulatory perimeter could be adjusted as needed. So there's potentially the ability. However, I am very skeptical about this, about whether this will actually be ever used in a timely way. I think it's always going to be late. The third thing that's good is the Dodd-Frank Act does provide a means for a resolution of a complex systemic financial institution outside of bankruptcy, and that's contained in the orderly liquidation authority of Title II of Dodd-Frank. And some of the more major structural weaknesses that I think made the securities industry even more vulnerable have been addressed, and that includes reforms to the money market mutual fund industry and the reforms that we've done to tri-party repo system. On the negative side, well, there's this issue, will the FSEC act in a timely way? But there's also the issue of the fact that there's no lender last resort available for non-bank financial firms except in extremis, and the fact that the Fed's Section 13(3) authority has been constrained, as the Fed can no longer lend to a single firm under Section 13(3). That basically rules out the type of interventions that were undertaken in the case of Bear Stearns and AIG. I think many other people who have worked on these papers would like to move in the opposite direction, to have a system similar to what we actually have for commercial banks, have a lender last resort available as a normal course of business, not an extremis, to systemic non-bank financial firms with an explicit quid pro quo. To get this, you have to be subject to appropriate prudential regulation and supervision. I have to say I'm disappointed that not only do we not have this, it's not even being seriously debated. So what are the lessons learned? Well, the most important lesson from my perspective by far is that the regulatory regime has to keep up with the evolving financial system. And that's really going to be the challenge for the next generation. I don't know. I think this is one where you're probably going to fail again and again, but that's the challenge. Other key lessons include that in a crisis, you have to have the ability to act aggressively to get in front of the crisis, to contain panics and limit contagion. So to do that, the authorities need the authorities need the legal tools to be able to implement such actions in a timely way. The second lesson, I think, is that regulators do have to practice how they would coordinate their actions during time of crisis. Who's responsible for what? And is there a common understanding concerning responsibilities both nationally and on a cross-border basis? I think one area that isn't buttoned up enough is how we handle things when a global firm goes under. And third lesson is when asset quality is deteriorating, there is no good substitute for capital. Liquidity and a lender last resort backstop are necessary, but they're not sufficient. When the private sector is unwilling or unable to supply capital, the government may have to step forward. In my opinion, in the fall of 2008, the public capital brought forth by the TARP legislation was an essential ingredient for ending the crisis. But as we saw, the situation first had to get really, really bad for Congress to be willing to enact that legislation. And I think this underscores an important point that we may want to debate further. Even if Lehman had somehow been saved, the crisis would have continued. Other parts of the financial system would have broken until Congress acted and the public capital necessary to bolster the financial system become available. People have this notion that somehow if Lehman had been saved, everything would have been fine. No, the stress level would have continued. Other things would have broken until Congress acted and enacted TARP. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Maybe Steve and Scott, I have some specific questions, but can I ask your reactions to the big question that Bill posed, which is essentially, in what ways are we better off and in what ways are we not better off when you think about the growth of the finance outside of banks?
I think there are definitely, as Bill pointed out, some ways that we are better off. We have a resolution regime for not large financial firms that we did not have before. And I think that's a very powerful tool. It's in some ways meant to be a substitute for the constraints on 13(3), so that the Fed can't lend to those firms, but we can put them in resolution. That's a way to punish shareholders a little bit more, punish management a little bit more, but also keep an eye on financial stability in the process of resolving the firm. I think while that's a powerful tool, I think in some ways the liquidity and capital that might be needed for a large financial firm could come out of a resolution. It's a pretty unwieldy tool as well. So I wonder if how that would work if Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, AIG, Wachovia were all failing at the same time. Would the government be able to put all of them in resolution and manage that at the same time? So in that respect, I think the loss of a Fed lender of last resort authority is perhaps a mistake, because it is quicker and easier to provide some liquidity in an emergency than to stand up and manage a resolution. So I think the two tools would work better if they were both in place. We have the one, we're better off with having resolution, but there's a minus in losing the Fed lending authority. One place where I think we're better off is the Fed lending authority continues to exist and has sort of been accentuated in lending to central clearing, financial market utilities. And I think that is actually going to turn out to be useful in the future. We've designed our system now in a way where there's going to be more clearing and there's going to be more interconnection between the largest firms in derivatives and swaps and other kinds of instruments. And so those central counterparties become a node of risk and potential contagion. And I think the fact that the Congress has preserved the authority of the Fed to lend to them is a really useful useful tool. Obviously, losing the ESF is not a plus.
The Exchange Stabilization Fund that was used for the money market
fund
funds.
Treasury, that's right. Because that had such a potential for use by the Treasury, and so that leaves the Treasury, I think, with two arms tied behind their back instead of just one. So I do one other tool I think that is very useful is not so much a post-crisis tool, but a pre-crisis tool. I think the additions to resilience, supervisory authority, the focus on financial stability as a focus for regulators is a really important thing. We've had a lot of discussion today about the need for capital, and to the extent that the regulators are in a better position to both supervise and require capital on a broader range to the financial system, including non-banks, I think that's a positive.
Are you confident that if the authorities lent to a central clearinghouse that Congress wouldn't react in horror and close that off?
So, it worries me that, the Federal Reserve lent and was repaid fully with interest on all of its loans, and Congress rewarded the Fed by taking away their authority. I think that's always a risk. On the other hand, it's an important tool, and we're better off with that tool, and you have to use the tools that you have and deal with the consequences later on.
Steve?
I came to this as a fixer, not as a policymaker, so I'll sort of stay in my lane. I look at the world I've participated in the last 10 years, and I can't help but think about are we fighting the last war element of this whole conversation. What we see in the economy and what's happening in sort of the forefront of our industry is essentially it's the last act, but a major ongoing act in the disintermediation of what banks do. And we look at all these really cool companies that interface with consumers and take deposits now that aren't banks. And we look at all these really cool companies that make loans to individuals and corporations that aren't banks. And if we roll that clock forward 5, 10, 15 years, the trend lines we're on, two things come out of that phenomenon. One is that I think those institutions get bigger, more powerful, more important. And two, they lessen the importance and significance of the banks that we've spent so much time thinking about and creating a regulatory environment for. So when we wake up in the world the next time that there's a problem, these non-bank institutions that are essentially intermediating savings into investment and so forth, none of the things that we did and will be, I don't know that they'll be effective in assisting those institutions, and I do think those institutions are going to really hollow out our traditional banks that we spend so much time regulating and worrying about. The other thing that sort of depresses me a bit is somehow or another we participated, there was never any confidence, not a lot of confidence in us as decision makers on the part of the people who have the money on the Hill. And that feels more true today than it did 10 years ago, and it was pretty tough 10 years ago. And so I think about the need, again, the money market fund guarantee, which we can talk about, but the ability to use the ESF on the turn on a dime and do that and affect positive change, it's clearly that was a bad thing because we said we shouldn't do that again. And so our successors will just have that many fewer tools and I think be that much hampered and we will all be in that much more danger. Which turns me to my last point, which is after I left the government and spent some time teaching at Georgetown, I, I sort of learned what everybody who's been doing this for a living knew, which is whenever you have deposit-taking institutions and they don't have access to a lender of last resort, bad things will happen. It's just that simple. And the money market funds were, I think, the best. Somebody called them the dry tinder on the desert, on the forest floor. They continue to be effectively that. And the fact that we went through the crisis we went through, and we saw how much danger and how close they brought us to really serious problems, and we've effectively left them as they were, you know, more or less, just startles me. And I would expect more trouble from this sector in the future when there's a liquidity run.
I was feeling pretty optimistic this morning when I heard that we only have financial crises every 75 years, and I'm 64 years old, so I figured I'm safe. Unfortunately, my optimism has been completely dispelled in the last 20 minutes, so the bar will be open soon. So on this regulatory perimeter thing, so I thought the idea was that the FSOC was going to have the power to decide when institutions that were might not seem systemically important today become systemically important, that they could be designated. That was clearly the idea. It seems to me that that's been basically completely gutted. The combination of the lawsuits from the insurance companies and the current attitude of the FSOC, and it seems to me that we basically have defanged that tool. Do you agree or not?
Well, I mean, I think it comes back to what I said originally. We have the tool. The question is, will that tool be actually used in a timely way?
And the answer is?
And I think the answer is probably not. I mean, you know, one thing that's been a thread going through all these conversations is the political economy is much worse today than it was 10 years ago in terms of what you can actually do. Like, could you do TARP legislation again? If you did TARP legislation again, could you actually put the money capital into the banks? Would the banks actually be willing to take the capital? I mean, there's a lot of political economy elements that I think have gone very much in the wrong direction. And I think an interesting question is, what can we do to sort of push against that?
Well, the other thing is the FSOC was designed, again, to fight the last war. There were institutions that weren't in the system. We could name them. We had one or two hands to get them all. Well, okay, those institutions aren't there, or they may not be the problem. What if it's an entire industry? That's not what the FSOC is set up to do. And I say that, you know, when we think about private lending or private deposit taking. And the FSOC is not a tool to take that on.
Steve, you suggested that we haven't done enough on the money market funds. What is it that – well, let me start. Did you anticipate – did anybody anticipate the money market fund problem would follow? Lehman, Scott, did you want to weigh in? I'm sorry.
I wanted to weigh in on the last crisis.
Please.
Last crisis.
That's what we're doing today, weighing in on the last crisis.
But so I think there is one really cool aspect of FSOC, and that's that I think in the 1930s, Congress couldn't have predicted what the next part of the financial system would be that would cause trouble. And the idea of the FSOC was, you know, you've got an agency that's keeping a broader eye on the market developments and can be nimble and can move the regulatory framework as it needs to handle the developments in the market. And I think that's actually cooler than having Congress try to do that all the time, because it's very difficult to get new laws passed. On the other hand, for the reasons Bill mentioned, I think it's unlikely that it's going to work soon enough to make it useful, because it doesn't help to designate someone right before a crisis. You have to designate them far enough in advance that you can do something about it. And so I actually really like, or at least would want to think more about Bill's idea that another way to approach this is to have some emergency tools like a discount window facility that's open to financial institutions, but on conditions they agree to some supervisory framework. And that, you know, that provides an incentive for firms to think about where they might be in a crisis and what kind of help they might need in a crisis and prepare for it in advance. So there are other ideas out there that add the nimbleness of FSOC. I don't want to be entirely negative so that you don't have to rush off to the bar. I think there are other solutions to think about.
So I can see that Geithner is clearly having – influence here. The former general counsel of the Federal Reserve used the word cooler twice in reference to an element of...
I've been using it a lot longer.
Steve, on the money market funds, first of all, was this a surprise that Lehman was followed by breaking the buck at the primary reserve fund or the reserve primary fund, whatever it is? And then, so let's start with that. Was this one of those unforeseen?
Unforeseen.
It's kind of alarming.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the check and I around sort of the markets knowing best, I think we spent much of the summer after bear assuring ourselves that, well, everybody knows Lehman's next. Everybody knows they're in trouble. Surely all their trading partners are buttoned up. Everybody's adequately collateralized. There's no way anything bad could happen. Right. Not anything. But that we thought that the markets had sort of self-corrected and were taking things into account over the course of the summer. That turned out to be less true than we thought.
So
I think we knew it was going to be bad. I mean, it just was worse than that.
Right. I mean, I thought for people who haven't read it, Tim Geithner and Andrew Metrick have a kind of Socratic dialogue on the Yale website about Lehman Brothers. And I thought one of the most useful admissions that Geithner makes is we knew it would be bad, but it was worse than we expected, which has the ring of honesty to it. But Steve, we haven't done enough for money market funds. There's been a number of, with a great deal of struggle, the FSOC and the SEC put some new rules in place. There's now less money in the prime funds, which invest in corporate paper, and more money in the funds that invest in government securities, but you're not satisfied.
I just think the concept of having deposit-taking institutions, not having access to a lender of last resort, is profoundly risky. And with all due respect to the wisdom of the institutions and their desire to mitigate risk and to do the right thing, in the middle of the financial crisis, the vast majority of the money market fund owners told us, we don't want insurance. We don't need it. You're ruining our industry. And so the idea that they are going to, before the fact, sign up to some sort of government insurance program with attendant regulation on a voluntary basis, I think is not as fanciful. The behavior in the middle of the crisis, I think, is really instructive. I think the money market funds, the industry itself, was convinced that they brought no danger to the system, that they were prudently managed, that they had done everything they were supposed to do and weren't a risk. And I think we were 24, 48 hours from Armageddon because of that position. And so I think this is, again, one of those cases where the FSOC, it's not that there was any one particular money market fund that was a problem. It was having a patch of real estate occupied by a series of industry participants that collectively created this risk.
And we basically are still at risk.
Yes.
Do you guys agree?
I think still at risk, probably a little bit less risk in the sense that you have a floating NAV for the institutional prime funds, which I think is an important difference because you don't have the incentive to get there first, and the fact that the prime funds are much smaller. So still a risk, but I think at least we moved in the right direction.
Scott, I don't want to litigate the entire Lehman thing in the time we have. Well, actually, I'd like to, but I'm not going to. But there are two things that have been raised, and I'm sort of curious because they're both legal issues or in part legal issues. One is, Bill, you as well, what difference does it make if somebody becomes a bank holding company? Lehman, you in your paper, you say you considered making investment banks bank holding companies in June, decided not to do it. After Lehman fails, you allow Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to become bank holding companies. What difference does it make? And B, what are the criteria that the Fed use? Is it judgment or legal to decide whether a firm can become a bank holding company?
So let me take the market sense, and I'll turn it to Scott for the legal aspect of it. Look, I think our judgment was that it wouldn't really do very much substantively, because you still have all the 23A restrictions on lending. You can't lend to the securities sub of a bank holding company. So Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs were still going to have these very large securities firms that the Fed couldn't lend to. But it would be in some way an endorsement of the firms that the Fed is thinking that they're viable. That's why they're letting them become bank holding companies. And coupled with the fact that we wanted Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to go out and raise private capital, it's the combination of those two things that we thought were successful, would be helpful. So it's not that we thought that making them bank holding companies was all of a sudden going to save the day, but if they became bank holding companies and they went out and raised outside capital, which both Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs did, we thought in combination that would make people in the marketplace feel that they had a viable business model, and that they would be able to survive. And even that said, it was a very close thing, especially for Morgan Stanley. It was a very close thing.
Scott?
Yeah, so Bill's got it exactly right. From a legal side, there was no difference. They got no greater access to the discount window by becoming a bank holding company. They got no special privileges by being a bank holding company. It was, I think, as Bill said, the imprimatur of the Federal Reserve had some value to it, that somebody in the middle of the crisis, when nobody knew what the real strength of an organization was, some independent group with quality analysis and standards evaluated the balance sheet and the financial resources from the government and then from the private sector. And both of them agreed that these are companies that met some minimum standards at a time when everybody was uncertain about it. And I think that was the best value that it had. But clearly, without the private capital, I don't know that it would have worked as a device.
Wouldn't work for Morgan.
So, but the 23A, this rule that the Fed can't lend to the broker, you waived that for Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. So that can't have been.
So not exactly. So 23A limits the funding that can come from the bank to the non-bank side. What the Fed waived was, so it applies not just to loans or funding that goes through, but purchase of assets. And what the Fed did was allow the bank to purchase assets from the non-banking side of Goldman and Morgan Stanley that could have been originated by the banks to start with. So, you know, it was a way of getting some funding through, but if you were looking for a door to provide strong amount of liquidity to the broker-dealer, it would be tough
Okay, in the paper you say that you refer to become a bank holding company, you have to demonstrate sufficient financial and managerial resources to meet regulatory and supervisory requirements and to safely and soundly continue operations. Is that a legal standard, or is that just what the practice of the Federal Reserve System
is? No,
that's
a statutory standard.
I see. Okay. All right. Second question for you, Scott and Bill. I'll get to you in a minute. I'm not going to let you off the hook. So a lot of the question about Lehman has to do with collateral, and the 13.3 section of the Federal Reserve Act says that a loan has to be secured to the satisfaction of the Reserve Bank. How did you go about defining what secured to the satisfaction meant, given that this hadn't been used very much in the last 75 years?
Well, so there was a lot of soul searching about that, and we finally decided in the end that the best way to figure it out is just to go ask the Rolling Stones what would make them satisfied.
What was that?
Yeah. So there, you know, secured to the satisfaction is obviously a bit amorphous, but the 13.3 and 10B, the two authorities we used most for lending, both have that standard, and they both are exclusively lending authority. So, you know, the Fed had a long history of lending, and I think it always understood that as lender of last resort, it was not to provide capital. It was not providing grants. It was providing funds with the expectation of repayment of those funds. So looking at collateral then becomes an exercise in deciding whether you feel secure enough that you're going to be repaid for the funds that you've been lent to the organization. And you know, we had through the discount window a long tradition of lending and evaluating collateral and applying haircuts to the valuations to decide what amount of collateral would be be appropriate for that kind of credit. And we've applied a similar kind of standard to the non-banking side. So were we reasonably expecting to be repaid in the credit?
I think that's the right standard. I think what's different for securities firms compared to commercial banks in terms of discount window lending is if you're an insured depository institution, you probably have plenty of collateral because a whole portion of your balance sheet doesn't have to be collateralized. That's the part that's insured by deposit insurance. So for security firms, it's a lot different. Collateral actually can be quite scarce. And one thing that happened in the crisis that wasn't commented on very much in the valuation was the collateral oftentimes was in the wrong place, and it wasn't often easy to move the collateral to the right place or to get an appropriate claim on that collateral. And a lot of this was the fact that the firms themselves had very, very poor data systems. They were very complex in terms of corporate form. And so it wasn't just a question of did the firm have enough collateral or not have enough collateral. It was also could they move the collateral to the places where they needed to move the collateral to actually secure the loans.
I think that's actually a really important point because when you look at a balance sheet of a bank, you can get a sense of how much it can borrow from looking at its assets because the deposits are not securing those are not secured by those assets. But with a broker-dealer, since they're using their assets actively to raise funding all the time, they aren't going to have the level of collateral that's unencumbered. They have plenty of assets, perhaps, but they're using them actively.
A problem if you get your dream here and we can lend our last resort to broker-dealers, right?
Maybe, maybe not. It depends on the regulatory scheme that goes along with having access to the discount window. You could require certain amounts of liquidity, capital, and unencumbered assets.
Right.
And you could require through the supervisory practice that they actually know what their
collateral
is and have the ability to mobilize that collateral in a timely basis.
Over the final weekend at the Fed, when we were parsing through Lehman's balance sheet, which was a roughly $600 billion balance sheet, the hole that we were sort of assigning to Wall Street to fill was some $30 billion. And the idea was that the assets that were left, that were free to be pledged, were, I guess one standard to think about was, were they worth more or less than the amount that you were trying to borrow against them? And in the case of Lehman, there were assets that at one point had been worth $50 billion that were now arguably the market was saying was worth $30 billion. And would somebody lend $30 billion or $20 billion against them? And certainly not $50. So this notion of what's enough collateral sometimes is a function of what's the value of the collateral. But that was the leftover toxic assets on Lehman's balance sheet that ultimately we couldn't find some other party to lend to.
Steve, is there any – I know autos is a bit awkward to put into this conversation, and it began in the Bush administration, was finished by the Obama administration. But are there any lessons about the auto industry bailout that we should take away? What criteria do we use to judge whether that was a success or not?
That's a tough one. I think of the auto bailout is sort of there were three pieces to it that I guess I would at least organize my thoughts around. First, there was assisting the auto finance companies, which were central to the car makers, but looked at as a finance person, they're just like any other financial institution. And so once the decision was made, their balance sheets resembled that of they were more like a bank than a car company. And so there was a decision taken to include them in the sort of CPP-like assistance that we gave to other financial institutions. As far as the government's decision to aid an industrial business, whether it's a car maker or a steel maker or something like that down the road, I think that's really outside the purview of what we saw as our central mission, although I can't help but note that it was probably the most popular thing that happened in the eyes of the public.
Even though it lost money, unlike the banks.
So maybe there's some logic in that.
Maybe if it lost more money on the banks, they'd be more popular.
Like us more. Yeah, that's really good thinking. I think the other thing that was unique that I – just a small footnote, at least the Chrysler Financial was a particularly odd thing because it was owned by a private equity firm. And the interplay that the Obama administration dealt with, whether to save Chrysler or not, we didn't have the time to sort of have those debates. But we were trying to sort through. We in order to keep the car companies alive for the next administration, Chrysler Financial was there, and Cerberus was negotiating hard for their own economic interest, and it was kind of an odd situation to be a government servant in what felt like any other commercial negotiation dealing with them. But it's a footnote, I think, to the larger public policy issues.
There's a question from the audience. The Exchange Stabilization Fund was created by Congress expressly for the purpose of, as the name implies, foreign exchange and U.S. dollar stability. So while it's nice that the Treasury Secretary has this slush fund he can use for whatever purpose he wants, is it really legit to say, oh, this was for the money market funds and it's a tragedy that that power was taken away?
Well, I'm looking at Bob Hoyt, who rendered the judgment to us that it could be used for such a thing. I think the rules are the rules. They were drafted the way they were drafted, and the stability of I look at exchange stabilization. Stabilizing the dollar is central to anything we were trying to do, and so
exactly.
I don't see our actions at all inconsistent with. What the letter of what the fund's enabling legislation said.
You guys have your lights on because you want to say something, or just have your lights on?
So I agree with what Steve said. I think that particularly as the financial system grows and internationally and becomes much more integrated, the dollar and the effect on foreign markets is going to be much more significant from troubles in the United States. So I think actually it's not hard to draw the conclusion that the Exchange Stabilization Fund, as it's written right now, or as it was written at the time of the crisis, I should say, could serve that purpose. So, and any tool that you have is a useful tool. Otherwise, if you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and that just doesn't work. Not everything is a nail in the crisis.
Bill, you made the point, a good one, I think, that while we've made some progress on resolution, one of the things we learned during the crisis is that these things spread pretty quickly from one country to another, particularly when we have global financial institutions. Lehman was one example, but of course not the only one. So how much should I worry about the fact that we've made not very much progress on how to resolve the collapse of a financial institution that sprawls across borders?
Well, I don't want to overstate it. I mean, I think.
Oh, go ahead. You're not at the Fed anymore. You can overstate.
We have made some progress. I mean, there actually are tripartite exercises where people are actually talking about what the responsibilities are. And every time we've done those, we've learned new things that we hadn't thought about before that we need to address. But, I think.
When you say tripartite, what do you mean?
Like ECB,
Bank of England, and the Fed.
Federal Reserve. So there's been discussions like that I think are helpful to try to sort out what's supposed to happen. But one example of what's interesting about those discussions is who's going to be the spokesman when you have a financial crisis? It's probably going to be the finance minister. When are they going to be drawn into the conversation? Probably very late. So even that's like a shows you some of the problems are in terms of responding to a crisis. So look, I think we're in a better place than we were before. But until you actually do it, everyone's going to run. The next time we get into the situation, people are going to run because one of the fundamental issues that are out there is the cost of running is really low. And so if you have any sense that it could go badly, you're going to run. And so until we pull this off well, it's going to be hard to imagine that the first time is going to go very smoothly.
Dudley calls for collapse of major international finance systems so we can get more practice.
How about a minor collapse?
Yeah. Maybe a Luxembourg bank. Scott, this is directed to you. I'm not sure you should be the only one that has to answer it. What was the thinking about setting up Title II of Dodd-Frank to resolve financial institutions as opposed to just altering bankruptcy procedures so we didn't need to involve the government so much?
So the advantage of Title II over bankruptcy is multiple. One, the clearest advantage is there's a source of funding that's guaranteed for the resolution. that I'm not sure how you could change the bankruptcy code in a way that would make that happen, other than, you know, because you would be giving the funding over to a band of creditors to decide how that funding would be distributed. That creates its own sort of problems. It also, I think, creates the idea that instead of just worrying about the repayment of creditors, you worry about financial stability. And again, I go back to, I'm not sure how the mechanism and structure of bankruptcy would allow that particular group, creditors, and even with court supervision, to take into account financial stability. Their incentives are not to take care of financial stability. The incentives of the creditors are to take care of the creditors. So there may be ways that that bankruptcy can be improved. I think that there's a lot of people thinking about that, and I wouldn't say that we shouldn't continue to try to work on improving bankruptcy to help in a financial crisis. But I think the central core of Title II is really something that doesn't transplant easily into the bankruptcy code.
In both the Lehman case and the AIG case, one of the big problems was derivatives and how extensively they were held and how hard it was to resolve them and who got stuck with the losses and all that. Is that a problem we've put behind us, or does that remain something we have, despite the central clearing, have yet to address fully?
Well, we've done a couple things on derivatives that I think are positive. One, central clearing of derivatives is very helpful because you replace a lot of bilateral risks with risks to the central clearinghouse. And there are tools to support the clearinghouse through lender of last resort. So I think that's very, very good. We're working on the closeout of derivatives problem. That's the one that we sort of have to solve. And ISDA is working on that, but it hasn't really been resolved. The closeout of derivatives problem is if a firm goes into bankruptcy and fails, people have the right to close out the derivatives trades if they want to. And so they close out the ones that are advantageous to them, and they leave the ones in place that are disadvantageous to them. And that creates a huge amount of turmoil in the market, and that was one of the most disruptive aspects of Lehman's failure. So we got to finish the task of managing so that if there is a Title II resolution, that the derivatives book just moves into the new recapitalized company without triggering the closeout. And I think that's going to be done. I think we're going to make it to that point, but we haven't quite got there yet.
All right. Well, that. Join me in thanking this panel and introducing the next one. The next panel is on the minor issue of government-sponsored enterprises and housing. The moderator will be Neil Kashkari, late of the TARP, now of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. The lead speaker will be Michael Barr, and the panelists will be returning for a second appearance, Dan Jester and Andreas Lennart from the Federal Reserve Board.
Good afternoon. My name is Neil Kashkari. Let me just offer the standard disclaimer that my remarks reflect my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve. You know, the most common question I'm asked about housing and the financial crisis is, why didn't we do more for homeowners? And, you know, couldn't we have just taken the $700 billion and instead of focusing on banks, just focus on homeowners? Wouldn't that have solved the crisis? And just to kick off the discussion, I'm going to turn over to Michael here in a second. My reaction is the U.S. economy had a massive heart attack. And why does a heart attack kill the patient? A heart attack kills the patient because it deprives blood to their critical organs. And if you have a heart attack, heaven forbid, you go to the emergency room, the surgeon's not going to operate on all your organs. The surgeon's going to go right for the heart to stabilize the heart to get blood flowing to the organs. And that's why the capital programs that we talked about earlier were so focused on getting blood flowing in the U.S. economy again, or getting credit flowing again. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to ignore all the organs, or ignore the American people, or ignore housing. So the purpose of this panel is to talk about what are the actions that we took to try to stabilize housing, to get credit flowing, to modify mortgages, et cetera. Those were necessary complements, but could not have been replacements for the direct intervention in the financial markets. So with that overview, I'm going to turn over to Michael Barr, who's going to be our lead presenter, and then Dan and Andreas are going to offer their own commentaries.
Great. Thanks so much, Neil, for that framing, and thank you all for the organizers for putting this together. What I thought I'd do is just start off with a little data context, and this is just a look at the distribution of single-family mortgages over the last 60 years or so. And the big takeaway from this, obviously, is that as a result both of changes in market practice and because of government policy, we've moved mortgages from the savings and loan sector to GSEs and private-issued mortgage-backed securities. So you can see that in the very large rise in the, I guess you could call that taupe colored segment. And then you can see in the lead-up to the financial crisis the significant spike in the private mortgage conduit as a way of funding a subprime, but also Alt-A and some prime mortgages. And this is important to see because one of the first things that the government had to do was figure out how to continue to have mortgages be issued when the financial crisis, when the financial sector was collapsing. And one of the most important things that either administration did with respect to housing was first to work on the passage of HERA, the Housing Economic Recovery Act, in the summer of 2008, and then to place the GSEs into conservatorship with a Treasury backstop on their capital in the fall of 2008, and then subsequently three additional agreements to place additional capital behind Fannie and Freddie, because if that step had not been taken, there would basically have not been a functioning mortgage market at all for anyone, let alone for individuals who were falling behind on their mortgages. So with that basic backstop, I'll just pull a couple charts from the chart book that you have in the back that our team helped with. But let me just thank David's team here at Brookings and the Yale team for the extraordinary job on these. You can see the government's housing programs implemented over time, beginning really with private sector Hope Now work, with the FDIC's work on doing mortgage modifications with IndyMac, which set a benchmark that we then used in the HAMP program of a 31% debt-to-income ratio for modified mortgages. You can see also the introduction of the HAMP program for modifications and HARP, which is an aspect of the refinancing programs. Don't you love these acronyms? And the important thing that you can see really is that in the bottom black chart, bottom black bar, the course of foreclosure completions, and these really are rising continuously over the period 2005 to 2010. And then with a combination of these steps in the housing sector, foreclosure completion rates start to come down from 2010 forward. You can also see it in the continued effort to have mortgage flowing. And here you can see the rapid diminution of the private market for mortgage-backed securities and the GSEs taking over that role, continuing lending into this market. And in this chart, you get a sense of the implementation of some of the key mortgage modification programs, both in HAMP and in the GSEs more broadly, as well as by the private sector and their role in reducing foreclosure completions. I think one of the things that is very hard to explain is the full range of programs that were offered in the housing sector. I think in the public mind, that tends to be focused on the HAMP modification program. And you can see that HAMP is a relatively small part of the overall modifications, refinancing, and other foreclosure relief conducted during the financial crisis. So HAMP permanent modifications that didn't redefault are about helped about a million people. But if you look at the HAMP modifications and then you add in the Hope Now proprietary modifications that after 2009, generally speaking, met a very good standard for reduction of payment. And you add in the GSE's HAMP-like modifications that were not funded by TARP, you're at about 9.2 million modifications over the cycle of these programs, that is through 2017. Similarly, if you look at HARP, a program was set up to help people who are underwater refinance their GSE-owned mortgages. HARP helped about 3.4 and change million households. In addition to that, the FHFA and the GSEs put in place a streamlined refinance program for people who are not underwater but otherwise wouldn't have qualified for refinancing. And that helped another 4 million households. And the Federal Housing Administration also put in place its own streamlined refinance program that helped another 2 million households, so 9.5 million of these special refinances. And then there was a wide range of other programs that were put in place during the financial crisis. I won't go into all the details of those now, but those helped another 5.6 million households. So if you look, you know, overall at the program, while it's the case that I think all of us would say we wish we had done more faster for helping more people, to help more people, that the reach of these programs is significantly larger than I think the public believes. I think the other point I want to make, and I know we don't have a lot of time, is that the quality of mortgage modifications that were done in these programs was significantly better than the kinds of modifications that were being done prior to these programs being instituted. And this is just one measure of this, looking at how monthly payments decrease. And you can see, for example, in the industry, monthly payments were decreasing only 42% of the time in 2008. By 2012, they were at 90%. Where for the GSEs, monthly payments were decreasing 45% of the time in modifications before the programs were put in place, and after at 96%. So let me leave the slides to the side and say, what did we learn about implementation? The first point, which many other panelists have been making throughout the day, is there is huge uncertainty during the implementation of these programs about what would work, what wouldn't work, and what was actually going on in the market. And there was an enormous amount of friction in the system. So unlike the capital purchase programs where you're working with a large but defined set of financial institutions, in the case of mortgage modifications, you're trying to reach millions of individual homeowners with individual workouts, and a huge friction in the system. The role of servicers in having to implement the system, servicers that were often broken and ill-equipped to deal with mortgage refinancing, was a huge barrier to implementation. I think many of us, all of us who wrote the paper, Phil Swagel, who's not here today, would join in this, think that the kind of experimentation we did was really useful because there is no silver bullet, but we wish we had done more of it and faster, and perhaps had gone bigger, much bigger at the beginning, had we known afterwards what results we would have. So I'm out of time. Let me leave it there and open it up to the panel.
Thanks, Andreas. Why don't we turn to you?
Thanks very much. Let me just make three additional points that Michael didn't touch on. I think first and sort of most important, if I could go backwards in time, if there's one piece of information I can convey to myself back then, to other policymakers, was, the focus on negative equity, on strategic default, that occupied so much of, our time and attention in the early, especially in the early parts when we were trying to figure out, what was the problem, was a little bit misplaced. it was, which is not to say there wasn't a lot of strategic default. There was. A lot of people who could pay their mortgages walked away. But the overwhelming majority of defaults were among people who were trying to make their payments. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence that lots of borrowers out there were, you know, scrimping to try to make their mortgage payments. And in fact, that had, as I'll come to it in my third point, that had a somewhat pathological result. So the most successful and cheapest form of modification would have been a payment, and was actually the payment reduction modifications, you know, that, you know, formed the bulk of the modifications. Second point, you know, it's, you know, these days we have a lot of data on mortgage markets, on housing. You know, we've linked mortgage data with credit reporting bureau data, with the deeds records. So we understand, you know, where are the mortgages, you know, what is the mark-to-market LTV, how many people out there are underwater right now. In the early days of the crisis, that stuff was seemed impossible. There was a complete lack of even sort of basic data. First time I ever spoke to Michael was during the transition. He phoned me trying to figure out, you know, some, you know, basic numbers, like, you know, what fraction of the mortgage market was underwater. And, you know, we discussed the data limitations and so forth and agreed that it's difficult to make policy when the uncertainty bounds include $1 trillion one way or the other. And so even in those days, you know, that was real money. Yeah. Local governments were desperate to understand how many of these bad loans do I have, even delinquent loans, forget about, you know, at-risk loans, and where, what zip codes, what streets, where, you know, where are these people, who are the underlying servicers. On my list of talking points here is taking another swipe at servicers, but Michael handled that. I'll skip over that. And then finally, you know, second liens were a problem, and it's worth maybe spending just a minute on them because they're a little bit of a symptom of something that I think that particular problem isn't going to be repeated, I hope, but something like it, no doubt, is going to emerge at some point. It seemed like a very sort of good idea. People can't make a big down payments, so maybe they can borrow part of their down payment, and you know there'll be a junior lien that's associated with that. But in the end, you know, it really exacerbated the, you know, the problems of, you know, figuring out who borrowers needed to talk to in order to, you know, come to some agreement with their lenders. You know, there were certain pathological instances where, you know, homeowners were kind of desperate to pay anything that they make any kind of payment that they could. So they would pay their junior liens if they couldn't afford their senior liens. And the result was, you know, that these things were sort of difficult to extinguish.
Thanks. Dan, you want to talk us through some of the GSE actions?
Sure. I'll just make a few comments on the GSEs. Michael made a reference to it earlier, but the act of placing the GSEs into conservatorship we thought was a necessity based on the capital situation that we assessed at the time in the summer of 2008. Notwithstanding the fact that these companies had very significant positive gap net worth on their financial statements, the true economic net worth was substantially negative. That was confirmed with analysis led by the Federal Reserve and the OCC, who took a look at the when they became designated as a consultative regulator for the first time, gained access to the same information that FHFA and prior to that OFAO had received on the enterprises, and led by Tim Clark, with a team of others, they helped us very, very materially in analyzing the situation of the GSEs. And as I say, there was a very material negative net worth. That was borne out by subsequent experience, where notwithstanding the positive reported capital they had, you know, ultimately they had to draw more than $190 billion under the preferred stock purchase agreements that we put in place. That action to place them in conservatorship was very important. It provided the timeout and provided the GSEs the ability to continue operating and providing the important credit to the housing finance market. They were the only game in town at the time, doing more than 80% of the volume, and without them, the crisis would have been much deeper and more problematic. I think the lessons that we drew from that experience are, number one, that the regulatory capital standards that were in place prior to the crisis were wholly inadequate. You can't say you weren't warned about the topic. People dating back many years on both sides of the aisle had raised this point, but sadly nothing was done to address it. The other thing I would say is that conservatorship, again, in addition to providing the flexibility for the GSEs to continue to operate and support housing finance, it also enabled policymakers to, frankly, respond to other topics. We had rushed to resolve the GSEs prior to other clouds that we saw, storms that we saw brewing on the horizon, and we thought it was very important. You don't get a lot of credit for it. We thought it was very important that we'd resolve the GSEs before we had to deal with all the things that occurred later in the fall of 2008. I'd say the last thing, we sometimes get a question. It's been 10 years. Congratulations, nothing's happened with the GSEs. Should you have put in place a mechanism to, you know, force a resolution prior to this date? And as we look at it, we think, no, we should not have had a forcing mechanism. Our mission was not to design a GSE reform plan when we placed them into conservatorship. It was to forestall a devastating systemic collapse of the GSEs and what the attendant knock-on effects to other financial institutions, the attendant knock-on effects to homeowners and the like. And so we very much wanted to structure a plan that would stabilize the GSEs and bring them to operate as is. The resolution is of the ultimate fate of the GSEs is up to Congress, and that's where it rightly belongs.
Thanks. So, Michael, one of the tensions I think we all faced in our housing programs and foreclosure programs was some people said you need to be more aggressive, reach more homeowners. At the same time, we were getting criticized if people who were not, quote unquote, deserving were getting help. And there was an inherent tension between helping lots of people and minimizing waste. Could you just talk about how to navigate that, and did we navigate it appropriately?
Sure. No, I do think there was not just from the outside, but from the inside, you know, wanting to run a tight ship, wanting to run a program that that met our expectations for using taxpayer resources. And so we ended up designing a program that was that required, for example, extensive documentation to do a modification. In a narrow sense, that might have been a good choice in terms of assuring the integrity of the program, insulating the program from criticism from SIGTARP or from Congress, making sure that, again, everything was run as a tight ship. But it did have the effect of making it extremely hard to actually run the program because servicers were really not set up to do real modifications, and servicers ended up losing documents, not reporting documents. Borrowers had difficulty getting all the documents in, or the borrowers didn't get all the documents in that they needed. And there were probably, you know, several hundred thousand borrowers, homeowners, who we could have helped if we hadn't had those requirements. And Treasury, in the end, by 2013, decided to put in place a streamlined program without that kind of extensive documentation. I think that was a good decision, but I wish we had probably made it earlier.
So, Dan, turning to the GSEs, one of the things that was so powerful about the actions that were taken were that they were backed up by an unlimited authority from Congress. And it seems like when you have the full unlimited capacity of the U.S. government, you can do pretty extraordinary things. I'm just curious, you know, what was the hardest part about designing the solution to the GSEs? Because clearly it worked very, very well in stabilizing them. But then what lessons do you draw on other parts of the response based on what was so successful in stabilizing the GSEs?
So the authority, which you described as unlimited, I think we've also in the past referred to it as unspecified and constrained only by the federal debt limit, which at the time wasn't that big of a deal. It's a much more significant topic today. But that was a very powerful mechanism to have that. And, you know, frankly, you know, the conservatorship of the GSEs, it would have been hard to make that work without that commitment embedded within the legislation. I think, you know, I don't have a lot of regrets over how we implemented the conservatorship of the GSEs. I wish
we could all gather here today 10 years later and say that the GSE ultimate resolution had been decided. And so that's a disappointment, but it wouldn't cause me to change anything about what we did at the time.
Let me just add to that. In addition to being the HERA authorities being important for the basic backstop for Fannie and Freddie, they were also really essential for running the mortgage modification program, because the GSE's own mortgages they modified were not backstopped with TARP resources. They were backstopped with HERA resources. That meant there was more flexibility for them to do more. It also provided us with the ability, working with FHFA, to stabilize state and local housing finance agencies in partnership with Fannie and Freddie. And that did a lot to stabilize local housing markets. Things would have been much worse on the ground in many cities without that.
But one of my takeaways, though, is backed by that unlimited or unspecified authority, when I think about all the different components of the response, the GSE response seemed to have been the most effective immediately. You know, with Treasury and OFAO, that now FHFA took the action, all the risk was taken off the table immediately, as opposed to just about everything else we did. When actions were taken, markets said, well, maybe we believe you, maybe we don't believe you, maybe we're going to test you. I mean, are there other lessons we could draw? Imagine if we had that type of an authority that we could have applied to housing more directly.
Well, I'd say, just speaking to the GSEs, the structure we put in place endured. It did require amendments after the initial architecture that we announced. For example, we announced a commitment of $100 billion each per GSE. Subsequent administration took the view that those limits needed to be increased, which was fine. The important thing was that we were able to design a structure that permitted those amendments to be made easily and still comply with the restrictions that Congress had included in the legislation that they passed. So I think you're right, Neil, that the GSEs were dealt with much more decisively and conclusively sort of at the first instance, and didn't require as many additional seeming new programs or new introductions thereafter. A lot was happening, though, underneath the hood as that was going on.
I mean, I was going to say, in February 2009, the Obama administration doubled the caps. So there was, and then there were two subsequent amendments after that increasing the caps. So I think that Dan's right in the sense that the structure permitted that, but the market and the GSE still needed a huge additional capital infusions effectively after the initial PSPAs were put into place. So I think that was also a work.
I mean, my only wonder, to what extent does the kind of implicit government backstop that existed pre-crisis and the kind of the market's kind of comfort with the idea that somehow the government stood behind these entities, how much of that sort of played into, you know, the apparent smooth operating of the program? They just assumed that you guys would figure it out. They'd been betting on that all along, presumably.
Yeah, well, through our actions in placing the GSEs into conservatorship, we converted an implicit guarantee of the U.S. government into an explicit guarantee. And that's functionally what it was.
Yep.
And so I think people took great comfort from that.
Let me turn to some of the questions. One of the questions we got from the audience is, would it have been possible to introduce a one-time standard rewrite of mortgage debt to reduce implementation costs and support housing markets? If not, why not? Anybody want to take that?
I mean, I think that if Congress had enacted bankruptcy reform, a so-called cram-down legislation, then individual mortgages could have been renegotiated in that manner, but there was not an existing legal mechanism to do what you just described, and certainly not on a mass basis.
Secretary Paulson, Hank, do you have a question?
Excuse me. I just had one comment about the GSE authority, because it was unspecified, and so that was huge. But it was also temporary to expire in October. December 2010.
Nine.
So just, 9 months into the Obama administration or so. And so this was an entity for the nationalization to work. This was an entity that was insuring 30-year maturity mortgages. And so that was a bit of a dilemma until there was some creative financial engineering to turn the temporary into essentially a permanent guarantee. And you know, it was done perfectly legally because there was the authority to put in preferred of a very long maturity. And the team designed a keep-all agreement or a backstop to work. But that, again, was something, it was very interesting when you look at where the criticisms came. And we were criticized, you know, over and over again for putting capital into banks and for some other things. And here was something where some of us that were making the decision said we're doing something that's perfectly legal, but it is not totally consistent with what we thought the congressional intent was, and it was necessary.
I wouldn't have said that. I would have said, it was 100% both legal and consistent with their intent.
You're right.
It may have been subject to criticism that it was not consistent with their intent, yeah. But it was definitely.
Dan, that's why you were so valuable during the crisis. Let me tell you, and I'm really glad I knew your number.
So let me ask the whole panel a question. One of the surprises for me about the GSE intervention was that it didn't buy us much time. It's, you know, after Bear Stearns was resolved, I think a bunch of us thought, okay, maybe the worst is behind us, and now we can breathe a sigh of relief, and it bought us a few months. Then the GSE started to show stress. Extraordinary work was done, put the GSEs into conservatorship. It bought us like a week, and then the next domino was falling. Any reactions on why that was?
Look, I think the reasonable inference is that people concluded that if the government was taking this step, that the losses were more severe than they had been assuming. And as a consequence, if the government is willing to commit its unspecified authority to stabilize the GSEs, then the embedded losses in other financial institutions were very significant. And I think it's that simple.
I mean, I think Dan's got an excellent point. I mean, I do think, but it wasn't just the perception of the problem. I mean, the reason that the GSEs needed a bailout and the reason that Lehman Brothers had so many assets that were difficult to value is because house prices were falling a lot, you know, delinquencies were rising. I mean, there was just a lot of losses floating around out there. And they were both, you know, both subject to the same, the underlying cause of both the GSE distress and the subsequent distress, you know, was the same. It was this rising tide of delinquencies.
And Andreas, during the financial crisis, I think when we met, you were deep, deep, deep in the weeds looking at all sorts of mortgage data to try to get a sense of how bad the problem was. When was it that you first said, oh my gosh, this is really bad?
Can you pick a time?
Yeah, I mean, I was on sabbatical in the summer of 2006, and when I left to go on sabbatical, things were looking pretty good. Katrina had hit, and delinquency had sort of spiked, but then they were sort of on their way back down. And then when I got back, delinquencies were shooting up, and you know, for me, it was. It's funny to see, you know, these timelines that you put together of the crisis that started in 2007, right? Because for me, and I think a lot of us who were working in the mortgage world back then, like maybe the Bronze Age of the financial crisis was, you know, in those months leading up to New Century's failure in December 2006, coincidentally when my oldest son was born.
Another question from the audience. Two big challenges in 08 and 09, which you all touched on, were impeding the housing programs, where mortgage servicers were, quote, I'm just quoting the questioner, totally overwhelmed and inept. And then secondly, mortgages. What steps, if any, have been taken to address the incentives that impeded the recovery efforts? Would it be better this time?
So let me I'll take a first stab at that. I think that it would be hard to overstate the problems in the mortgage servicing sector, both in the lead up to the financial crisis, then during the modification period, and subsequently, if you think about the problem with robo-signing, for example, that came up after the worst moments of the crisis were over, the servicers were still engaging in behavior that was really quite problematic. I do think that there have been some, you know, reforms that have been put in place to make the mortgage system work better today. many of those in the form of the Dodd-Frank Act's requirements with respect to risk retention, requirements around ability to repay and escrowing, the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And these, I think, will make the have the potential to make that the mortgage market safer and fairer going forward. And the the key difficulty there is we're in an era in which those reforms are very much at risk, and the CFPB has been pulling back on enforcement in a number of areas. And I do think that we're at serious risk of recreating the kinds of problems in the consumer markets that helped to feed these difficulties in the lead-up to the last crisis.
So, I mean, on the positive side of the ledger, you know, the shoddiest mortgage practices, you know, are now, you know, firmly confined to the dustbin of history. You know, liar loans, stated income, et cetera, all those things, you know, have... you know, aren't out there right now. So in that sense, you know, the system is safer. We haven't seen a reemergence of the private label mortgage-backed securities market, which in its pre-crisis incarnation led to, you know, highly fractured ownership of mortgages with, you know, poor incentives for the mortgage servicers. And then, as I mentioned, you know, second liens as a practice, you know, have not reemerged either. You know, so all of that is to the good. You know, I think, you know, one potential straw in the wind that should give us all pause is actually a paper that was presented here, Brookings, in the spring on the mortgage servicing industry that noted, you know, this very rapid growth in non-bank mortgage servicers, which isn't to say that, you know, they would necessarily not do as well as a bank at servicing. It's just they don't have necessarily the same liquidity resources that a bank-based servicer could draw on.
But is one of the implications of the current mortgage environment that... Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, one of the implications, if you look at the mortgage environment today, basically people with low and middle credit scores don't have access to mortgages. Or if you look at the averages for the mortgage written today are very high credit scores. So is the result of all of this that if you have some blemishes on your credit history, you're just not going to be able to get a mortgage?
I mean, I think that the FHA is providing a lot of, you know, there's a lot of FHA-based lending, and that is a sort of 3.5% down payment, borrowers with blemish credit histories. And I do think, you know, the mortgage market certainly sustained some damage. You know, the big constraint does seem to be around the kind of down payment. But I also wonder to what extent, you know, potential home buyers have lost their taste for housing. I mean, it did feel that there was a certain kind of speculative element to home purchase, especially sort of late in the credit boom, you know, leading up to the crisis. And so if that's not present, then we're just going to see structurally a lower home ownership rate.
We have, you know, progress to make on getting the balance right between access and affordability and the safety and soundness issues. And I think that I think we can do a better job improving access without developing the kinds of financial products that cause people to get in such trouble. So I think there's we are probably too far on the side of ignoring the access issues right now, and I think we can get the balance better.
Maybe this is just a starker way to ask Neil's question, which is one of the many ways we are different as a country in our exceptional differences is that, unlike most countries, we have decided not as a country to run a financial system where we substantially limit how much people can borrow against their home. We don't even do it where the government is the guarantor of the mortgages, but most countries have applied various forms of system-wide limitations. So I guess I'm wondering whether you think you would be, how you think about the costs and benefits of trying to run a system where you make it really, really hard to borrow more than 80% of the value of your house, or like many countries are meaningfully lower than that. Now, I know there's like access affordability constraints, but like say what you think about the merits. If you were unconstrained, would it be a better way to run the system? And worth the constraints, worth the cost, or do you think it's doesn't buy you that much benefits?
I mean, I do think that you need to deal with both access and affordability issues and the safety and soundness issues. So I don't think if you had a firm 20% rule across the board that would make sense. There are many instances of lower down payment mortgages being successful. But I do think you want to be careful about that sector, and you want to have appropriate safeguards in place to protect borrowers and to protect the sector as a whole from potential risk. I think that, you know, a lot of interesting work has been going on around having a kind of countercyclical LTV approach, or having much higher capital requirements for very high LTV loans, especially in a run-up before things get out of hand. So I do think that if you had a flexible approach that was countercyclical and that was not a fixed floor, that there's room to experiment in that area, but I wouldn't do a flat. You can't borrow over 20%.
So my reaction to your question is that not to answer directly that question. I mean, obviously benefits and costs to those sorts of rules. I think we'd all welcome a real debate on those sorts of issues. You know, it seems like as a country we could decide that there was a certain appetite that we had for risk in order to, you know, have homeownership rates, you know, rise above their current level. And then a reaction to Michael's point about a countercyclical LTV, you know, those kinds of time-varying financial regulations, you know, are very popular around the world at the moment. They were tried in the United States aggressively following World War II, and they met with intense political pushback. And you can read my paper with Doug Elliott and Greg Felberg, where we find, you know, very contemporary sounding debates where, you know, regulators are accused of instituting a credit police state, and, you know, sort of other, you know, similar sound bites. So I think that their potential use in the United States would definitely require a kind of public debate and consensus that this was a good idea, you know, in order to avoid just repeating what happened 50 years ago.
Hank.
I would ask Tim's, excuse me, how do I, can you hear me? So I would ask Tim's question in a certain, in a little bit different way. Do you believe we overweight and over-incent the value of home ownership in the United States? I mean, I've watched it change, you know, looking back over, you know, I can think back when we got our first home and in 1974, and the average, you know, home in the United States then was 1,700 square feet. Okay, at the time of the crisis, it was 2,700 square feet. The American dream sort of changed over time. You know, I remember thinking of American dream as you could come to this country and based upon your hard work and your abilities, you could achieve great success. Suddenly, the American dream became about home ownership, and homes morphed from becoming shelter to becoming an investment vehicle. And I look at all of this, and I'm not as focused on, you know, whether a mortgage is at 80% or 75 or 85%, down. I'm really focused on, do we have a system that disadvantages renters relative to home ownership, overvalues home ownership, and if we do, what's going to be done to change it?
I mean, one of my reactions to Tim's question and yours, and I think the challenge for all of us is, how do we institutionalize any of these lessons? Because we're all already forgetting about it. It's been 10 years. This is ancient history, basically, and this is going to happen again. So are there any policies that one could put in place now that can actually stand up to us forgetting? And I think something like an LTV cap, as blunt as it is and as much as it would attract, it would invite the market to try to game it. We know it would. It's better than nothing. We got to try something. One of the challenges is other countries that have imposed, you know, when they've imposed LTV restrictions to try to keep housing markets from taking off, they haven't been very effective. The housing market keeps taking off. That doesn't mean it's not worth trying. But I don't know, to my colleagues on the panel, what else could we do to institutionalize what we've learned so that our next generation and the one after that doesn't just repeat the same mistakes, if anything?
Well, I'm not, I guess I'm worried about the next generation, but I'm already worried about us. So I wish I had the luxury of waiting that long. No, I think we've already forgotten, really meaningfully, what happened, what the causes of the financial crisis were and what the consequences were as a country. And I think our politics in Washington right now are pushing us towards a set of steps that are going to make the financial system riskier and make it harder for individual households and that are putting taxpayers at risk more than they should be. And I see that continuing. So I'm worried right now. I'm not worried for 30 years from now.
Really?
Okay,
well, I'll make kind of a geeky point. So, you know, both Tim Clark and Scott Alvarez in remarks earlier separately touched on the fact that, you know, when sort of when the balloon went up and trouble started, that it turned out many of the firms didn't have the data and systems in place to actually understand the risk that they were taking. And sometimes I wonder, you know, was that sort of by design? You know, if you can't see the risk, then you can sort of pretend that it doesn't exist. But I also think that, you know, part of it is just the fact that people forget investing in data and systems is boring and expensive. But as long as we're actually sort of doing that, you know, as long as we can actually see and measure all of the things that are going on, right now we're focused on the housing market, but, you know, there are many other instances of this kind of thing, then, and we're sort of asking ourselves, how would all of these things behave in a really bad world? And taking a stab at answering that question, then we've gone a long way to kind of preparing for, you know, and preventing that kind of outcome from occurring.
So we have another question from the audience. Why was the successful New Deal program, the Homeowners Loan Corporation model, ignored in this crisis? It seemed to work during the Depression. It was there. I thought this person said I was there. Why was it ignored? I was trying to identify who you were. So somebody who studied, I think, Michael, you studied the Homeowners Loan Corp. Any thoughts on that?
Sure. I think that the Homeowners Loan Corporation was quite a successful model and one that we tried to incorporate into the basic design of the programs that we all worked on. So the Homeowners Loan Corporation had to start from scratch because there was no government entity at all available to process any workouts for homeowners. In the case of the financial crisis in 2008, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were in conservatorship. The FHA existed. So you had three very large entities that could be deployed and were deployed immediately to begin to do modifications. We would have been in a much worse situation if we had to build a whole new government agency from scratch. It would probably have taken, I mean, this is a guess, but about 2 years if we had been able to get legislation instantly, which we didn't have, to create such an entity. So let's say it takes 9 months in the best case scenario in that moment to get anything passed in on this issue. It would have taken a long time to get off the ground. So we were trying to take that basic Hulk model and use the existing entities, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, to act right away.
So let's look forward and think about the GSEs. Is there any mechanism, forcing mechanism, to try to catalyze action, or can they just sit in conservatorship for the next 100 years?
Again, I don't know about 100 years, but yeah, there's no political will, I think, to address them, and in their current status, no driving economic reason to address them. And so I think that the most likely outcome is that they'll still be in conservatorship when we next have a conference on the financial crisis.
Any other thoughts?
Nothing to say about that.
So when I look back, and Andreas, I'm going to kind of pick on you because you're the head of financial stability, the Division of Financial Stability of the Board of Governors. When I describe the fundamental cause of the crisis, I describe it as a mass delusion event where we all shared, and I bought a home in California in 2005, so I was part of the delusion. We all believe that home prices only go up. Or if they go down locally. They don't go down nationally. And that was a fundamental assumption underlying everybody's risk model. So when people say banks needed better risk management, I think risk management is a euphemism for wisdom. Banks needed to be wiser. Investors, regulators needed to be wiser. So what can we do to protect ourselves against future mass delusion events, which we know will happen?
I mean, just to first reinforce your point, you know, a paper that I did almost exactly 10 years ago this week, it's actually the Lehman Brothers weekend, Girardi, you know, Chris Girardi, Shane Sherlin, Paul Willen, and I documented, you know, the pre-crisis expectations that people had around house prices, and we were able to go back through various investment newsletters, and you know, find that people sort of were putting very low likelihood, like a 5% likelihood on you know, the worst case scenario was like a 5% decline in house prices, sort of my recollection. You know, how do you maintain the imagination? You know, there are lots of different sort of best practices that one could imagine. I think they all sort of have a flavor of being willing to contemplate things that have never happened before, right? And that's as I've sort of learned, it's very uncomfortable from a risk management perspective to hypothesize, you know, that, you know, certain prices could move, you know, outside of their historical distribution. You know, because people tend to use, you know, these models are so complicated, the system is so complicated, people tend to use the covariance structure, you know, the actual, what actually happened in the data through various stress events as the kind of scenarios that they use in their risk management. But I think we've all along recognized that, you know, thinking outside that is the, you know, it's the right way to sort of approach this kind of big, rare shock problem.
Dan or Michael? Want to weigh in?
I think that I agree with everything Andres said. I do think that having lots of different multiple perspectives brought to bear on the question of risk, having the regulators poking and prodding along with the financial institutions, having the Office of Financial Research poke and prod maybe in different ways from the Fed. So trying to get multiple perspectives, not relying on a single model, having stress tests and capital ratios, having people using network theory or matrix theory to think about a problem. So trying to get at it from multiple methodologies, I think, makes it less likely you'll make a tragic mistake. Just
so we have about 2 minutes left. Any Dan, any last comments?
I was just going to say I agree with the comments that have been made. I think, Neil, your question goes a little bit to how to be more wise, and I was going to say I don't have an easy prescription for how to be more rational and less human, subject to, you know, fear, greed, and folly, and it just happens. And so the insight I would draw from that is to say, recognizing that those cycles do happen and that unintended and unforeseen events occur, you have to design a system which can withstand those shocks. I think the most direct route to do that is to have a greater level of capitalization.
Amen. Any final comments? I think we're good. So please join me in thanking the panelists.